Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
The FT.
New retirement advice from the government. Work longer. Will elections in Brazil give a boost to the flagging emerging markets? And how to make money from collecting antiquarian books and first editions? Welcome to The Money Show, one of the FT's most popular podcasts. I'm Jonathan Ely, and I'll be giving you all the money news this week in downloadable form, with the help of my FT colleagues Joe Cumbo.
Hello.
And James Pickford.
Hello.
And we're joined on the phone by Anna Stupnitska, an economist at Fidelity Worldwide Investment.
Hello.
Barely a week goes by these days without more changes to the UK's pension system. 2 years ago, we had the start of auto-enrolment, the process by which employees are automatically signed up to workplace pension schemes. Then came changes to the state pension age, the flat rate state pension, followed by the momentous changes announced in this year's budget, and just last week, the abolition of the so-called death tax on pensions left to heirs. And this week came more pension rhetoric. Steve Webb, the pensions minister, said that Britons must get used to working longer or face almost permanent crisis in the nation's finances and in the health service. His department has set a target to increase the average retirement age by around 6 months for each year that passes, and seems particularly exercised by the numbers of people, especially in the public sector, who are retiring in their 50s. Mr. Webb and others argue that working longer is a natural consequence of living longer, and that pushing average retirement ages into the late 60s or even beyond is needed to compensate for the fact that more and more people are living into their 80s and 90s and requiring expensive healthcare. Joe Cumbo is here with a bit more detail. Joe, we should probably be clear straight away that what we're talking about here is average retirement age. It's not actually pension age as such.
No. Firstly, the state pension age is the earliest age at which you can claim your state pension, which is currently 65 for men, with women's state pension age rising to 65 to equalise with men by 2018. So it depends on when you were born, what your state pension age will be if you're a female. So you have the state pension age, and then you have the retirement age, which is actually an indicator which measures the age at which older people are leaving the workforce. And this is an indicator used by the government. Today, the average retirement age for men is 64.7 years and for women it's 63 years.
Okay, so they're actually quite well aligned at the moment, but the state pension age is going up, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Over the next 10, 11 years or so, it's going to hit 67 by 2026. So there's going to be quite a lot of movement. If there is no increase in how much time people are spending in work, then that gap between the state pension age and retirement age will widen.
Now, the government's pretty keen on older workers generally and persuading people to stay at work longer. What measures have they put in place so far to encourage us to do that?
Well, there's quite a lot that could be done to increase participation of older workers. And one of the key measures that they took was 3 years ago when they abolished the default retirement age. Many of our listeners might remember that as soon as you hit 65, your boss could march you out the door, but that was abolished 3 years ago. So that's opened the door for people to stay on longer if they wish. But the key problems that many people face in later life are that perhaps their health doesn't allow them to stay in jobs which are manual, and they can't keep up that manual work for long. And also there's the retraining aspect as well too. So if you're moving in and out or taking time off, and you might find it very difficult to get back into a job if you've been doing the same sort of work for a long time. Earlier this year, the government appointed a business champion for older workers to spread a positive message about keeping older people in the workforce.
And finally, I mean, you mentioned the sort of physical limits to how long people can carry on working, but there are also, of course, financial limits. Many people in the private sector won't really be able to contemplate the prospects of early retirement because they won't be able to afford it. But in the public sector, it's a sort of slightly different setup there. What measures is the government taking to persuade public sector workers to carry on for longer?
Right. Well, there is a big divide, as you said, between the public sector and the private sector. Nurses and doctors and teachers are still on schemes which are called gold standard final salary schemes, where income is based on the final salary at retirement, and that income will be index linked and will have spouse's benefits. Many other people who are not in final salary schemes do not get the certainty of a final salary pension. The problem has become, as people are living longer, these public sector pension schemes have become very, very, very expensive for the government and for the employers who still run these schemes. So what the government has been trying to do is to put a cap on the benefits that are being paid out to public servants in some instances, or they're increasing the age at which they can begin to claim their pension from the workplace scheme. So they're actually trying to tackle the costs of public sector pensions.
Thanks very much, Jo. Still to come on the show, making money from collecting vintage books and rare first editions. First, though, let's look again at emerging markets. These fast-growing economies produced great returns for investors for much of the noughties, but have underperformed the developed markets in more recent years. There's been a slowdown in China's growth rate, more questions are being asked of Russia's political leadership, and the end of quantitative easing in the United States has caused problems for many other emerging markets. But on the bright side, India has been one of the best performing major stock indices this year because of investor optimism about the country's new prime minister. He has pledged to boost investment and cut corruption and bureaucracy. Could the same now be about to happen in Brazil? Latin America's largest country was an investor favourite under its previous president, but seems to have lost its way under his successor, Dilma Rousseff. Widespread social unrest ahead of this year's World Cup demonstrated that for all its economic progress, Brazil remains a deeply unequal country with a large and angry underclass. In last weekend's election, Mrs. Rousseff did not win enough votes to secure outright re-election, and so faces a runoff later this month with Aécio Neves. He had trailed badly in the polls, but benefited from a late surge. He's a pro-business candidate who's in favour of free markets, just the sort of thing investors like to hear. The Brazilian stock market rallied strongly as it emerged that he had won over 30% of the vote. So, what happens now? I'm joined by Anna Stupnitska, an economist and emerging markets specialist at Fidelity Worldwide Investment. Anna, welcome to the Money Show. Let's try not to second-guess the results of the runoff at the end of this month, because it looks like it's going to be very close. But whoever wins, what sorts of problems is Brazil facing, and why has its economy sort of run out of steam in recent years?
Well, Brazil benefited from all the tailwinds that helped all other emerging markets throughout the last decade. And this included the rise of China, the commodity supercycle, the very easy financial conditions globally driven by the US. And also, starting from a lower base 10 or 15 years ago, it was easier to make progress. That also means that there is no incentive structure to reform. And now that these tailwinds are slowly turning into headwinds, all these domestic vulnerabilities are getting exposed. That's why Brazil seems to be running out of steam, and structural reform is absolutely key for the economy to do well going forward.
Now, a few years ago, people were saying, well, Brazil isn't just a commodity economy. It is, of course, a very big producer of commodities, but it has a buoyant middle class that's growing very fast and consuming more and more. What's happened to all that talk? It all seems to have disappeared.
Well, this is all well and good while the commodity prices are rising. And Brazil really has not managed to diversify from that dependence. And it's very much dependent on what's happening in China. And now China is on a structural slowdown path, and we expect that to continue. So Brazil really needs to think about other sectors.
Okay, and if we look at the Brazilian stock market relative, say, to developed stock markets and indeed relative to other emerging markets, how well or badly has it performed in recent years?
Roughly over the past 5 years or so, Brazil has underperformed both blocks by about 50% in US dollar terms. It has underperformed emerging markets by about 20% in local currency terms, and it has underperformed developed markets by about 40% in local currency terms. Yet today, it has moderately outperformed, somewhere around low single digits, and partly this has been driven about this excitement about the potential elections outcome.
Whoever wins the runoff at the end of this month, what do you think are the key things they need to do, that the sort of key self-help measures that the country needs to get back on track?
It's going to be about restoring these previous pillars of macroeconomic management, including inflation-targeted floating exchange rate and fiscal consolidation. That's going to be very important for the economy. That's what markets are looking for, and hence all the excitement for a potential turnaround story in Brazil.
Okay, so if I'm an investor and I'm looking at what looks like a fairly lowly valued cheap stock market and a potentially a president coming in who's going to do all the right things and I want to invest, what are the ways to do that? Should people go for a single country Brazil fund or a regional fund, or play it safe and go with a sort of global emerging markets product?
It's not about getting exposure to the whole of the EM universe. It's about picking those structural growth stories that are going to be more successful. And as I said, structural reform is absolutely crucial here. Looking across the emerging market universe, there are three countries in particular today that have the reform momentum, and they're China, India, and Mexico. So within Latin America, for now it's Mexico, but as I said, Brazil does have a potential to be a more successful story in the longer term, depending on the election outcome.
Thank you very much, Anna.
Thank you.
There's lots more on emerging markets in this weekend's FT Money. Merrin Somerset Webb writes about the latest goings-on in China. And John Redwood picks out the tension between Russia and Ukraine as one of the key risks facing all markets at the moment. FT Money is, of course, part of the Weekend FT, which is widely available on both Saturday and Sunday. You can also read online at ft.com/money or on tablet devices using our new web app. We're always keen to hear your views. If you're an investor in emerging markets, let us know what you think. The address is money@ft.com. On to our final item for today. Every so often on Antiques Roadshow, you'll hear a heartwarming tale of how a book bought at a jumble sale or found in an attic turned out to be a rare first edition worth a fortune. Despite the rise of the internet and e-readers like Amazon's Kindle, plenty of us still have shelves groaning under the weight of books. But can you actually make money from collecting them? And if so, how do you go about getting started? James Pickford has been looking into the rarefied world of antiquarian books. James, I guess we should start by saying this is really as much a hobby as it is an investment.
Yes, dealers and auctioneers in this business make a point of saying you should buy rare books because you love owning them. Something of cultural or artistic or scientific significance, and often something that's a beautiful object in its own right, not because you think you're going to make pots of money out of selling it in a few years. And part of the reason for this is that they are unpredictable as investments. You have to hold on to them for years, sometimes for decades, to see their value rise. And that value might fluctuate in a highly subjective way according to sort of taste or fashion over the period. And therefore, it's also not a liquid market. You can't expect to sell your book at a profit at any time. And indeed, some dealers say that trying to do so any less than around 7 years or so after you buy it, that this goes down rather badly in the book buying community. Nonetheless, the best rare book collections, which have been assembled over many years, can achieve high prices at auction or can get a very good price from a dealer. There was a big sale of English exploration and discovery books recently by the British collector Franklin Brooke Hitching. And this is a library of 1,400 books that this man began collecting in the 1960s. And the sale took over £6 million at Sotheby's, and that's if you include the buyer's premium. And this was well above its estimates. And of course, that's only half of the collection, which will be sold in two more tranches over the next few months. So it is possible to do well if you follow some basic rules about what you buy.
You mentioned a buyer's premium there. This presumably applies to selling at auction. Am I right in thinking that the sort of cost of buying and selling rare books can be quite high compared to, say, the cost of buying a fund?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you have a pot of money and you're just looking to do something with it, then rare books doesn't really come out well on transaction costs when you compare it to investment classes like, say, tracker funds. If you buy a really good rare book at auction, you'll find yourself paying a buyer's premium of as much as 25% at the top houses. Of course, if you buy off a dealer, they will have their margin. But because rare books are by definition rare, there isn't often a lot of opportunity to compare prices.
All those things notwithstanding, there are actually some tax advantages to owning rare books, aren't there? As there are indeed with many other alternative assets.
Indeed. You won't pay any VAT, any value added tax on books. And also, if a book is sold for less than £6,000, you will not pay capital gains tax on it.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago that tastes come and go and that what is valuable in the book world is a very subjective issue. What is sort of hot in the historical bestseller lists at the moment and what is less so?
Science and economics are doing rather well at the moment. And experts say that what you want is a book that contains the first expression of a scientific or artistic idea. Say, for instance, Copernicus's book, in which he revealed the fact that the Earth revolves around the sun and not vice versa. And that was the first time that was mentioned in print. That has sold at Christie's for £2 million a few years ago. But there can be book bubbles. So natural history, for instance, that went through a phase of strong buying from the late 80s for about 15 years, but has fallen away a bit now. And of course, when you get into literature, individual authors will have their trends and so forth. So at the moment, first editions of Harry Potter, the first novel, are highly sought after. But there are other things which have fallen away. So for instance, D.H. Lawrence is less fashionable now. Thackeray, the big 19th century authors, are less fashionable. And of course, 100 years ago, rare books in Greek or Latin would have been understood and enjoyed by a much greater number of people than today. So Greek and Latin books are a whole section of the market that over time is gradually disappearing or becoming less sought after.
And finally, James, the internet, widely blamed, of course, for destroying the book trade. If you're thinking of getting into antiquarian book collecting, though, the internet's surely a boon.
Well, the internet has indeed changed the market quite considerably by opening up the information on prices, on the value of a book, on what books contain. So all of the information that auctioneers produce in their catalogues is freely available on the internet. Dealers will often have a great deal of information put out there. You can track the historic prices of books. But some dealers say, well, yes, that's right, but that some of their best stuff may be held off the internet for various reasons. They either want to give it to people that they like or they want to just control its release on the market. So you won't necessarily get complete transparency. And in some cases, one or two dealers have said that prices have been chased down, particularly in the mid-market, by this transparency. So unless you're bidding for the very most sought-after works, you may find that prices of books actually fall because of the influence of the internet.
Thanks very much, James. There's more on how to get started with book collecting in this weekend's FT Money. You can also read my views on the party conference season. Be warned, they're not very complimentary. And we look at whether it's been better to invest in actively managed funds or just track an index. The Money Show will be back next week, but for now it's goodbye from me, James, Joe, and our special guest Anna Stubnitska at Fidelity Worldwide Investment.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's GRAMMARLY.com/podcast. Easier said, done.